From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, on the eve of a panel that brings together the four African Americans to serve as Milwaukee Common Council president, we talk with one of them about history, challenges, and his brief term as mayor.
Later, the TV show Wisconsin Foodie celebrates 10 years of celebrating the people who grow, prepare, and consume food here.
It has been 10 years for Wisconsin Foodie since the original iteration of the idea on the napkin and my call to Kyle Cherik. And then one cold, blustery day outside of the Milwaukee Public Market.
And from food to drink, we go behind the scenes at a Milwaukee distillery to learn how flouting conventions in the liquor world can lead to better results.
Do I have any ideas that I think would be a better way to do it? What I found in this industry is that conventional wisdom, it's not necessarily conventional wisdom because it's the best way to do something.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Leadership in Milwaukee at one level has been pretty consistent for a long time. Since 1948, the city of Milwaukee has had only five mayors. Four of them, Frank Zeidler, Henry Meyer, John Norquist, and Tom Barrett, represent 69 and two-thirds years in office.
There has been much more turnover on the Common Council and the presidency of the council. One person who's experienced both is Marvin Pratt, who served as mayor in the 4 months between John Norquist's resignation and Tom Barrett's election, and he was Common Council president from 2000 to 2004.
Pratt is the only African-American to serve as mayor here, but he and the other three African-Americans who have served as Common Council president will all be part of a panel conversation tomorrow organized by the organization Near West Side Partners. Executive Director Keith Stanley is with us in the studio, along with Marvin Pratt. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Keith Stanley, what is the overarching question you're trying to get at with this event on Thursday?
Mitch, that's thank you for having me here. And we're excited about Thursday's event. It's the Avenues West Luncheon. Avenues West is one of seven communities. And I would say the main focus is really, I would love to say it was a grand plan behind it, but it was the fact of seeing, I would walk in every day at City Hall and I would see a picture of this man I didn't know, Ben Johnson, on the wall at City Hall inside. You go inside the lobby there, foyer, and I decide, who is this guy? And I want to know, you know, what did he do? And then having some conversations with my former boss at the time, President Hines, and others, including Marvin here, I just thought, this is such a cool. We have four African American men who have sacrificed, despite what all the stuff they've been through, have been able to help my city become a better city in over five decades. And that resonated with me, 5 decades that these men have sacrificed and tried to make our community better. And they're all alive and doing well, from what I can tell. I said, I gotta get them in the room together, and I don't want that to be because of a funeral, because of a death. I really wanna get them in the room just to talk, to pick their brain, understand their motives, and just to get a clear understanding so it's documented in some way. And so we are gonna have it on Facebook Live for those who can't attend. But just to understand who they were or who they are as a people and what they believe are what makes our city valuable and important, how they contributed to that.
Marvin Pratt, as you think back on the time you spent in city government, both in an elected role and a behind-the-scenes role, were there sort of general hurdles that you had to overcome that kind of defined those years?
Well, I think you have to have had some idea of what you wanted to accomplish. And so I went in saying that it's going to make a difference. I remember a distant relative of mine saying, oh, Marvin, it probably won't make a difference that the night of my election, probably won't make a difference that you're elected to anyone but you. And I said, boy, you know.
It's a nice thing to say.
Yeah, I would say, I would hope it would. And so you go in with the idea that with a high degree of idealism and that you can impact people's lives positively in the city. And you may focus, and I'm going to say maybe my focus is probably on minority population in the city, and even specifically on the African American population, and the kinds of problems that maybe that are just paramount in Central City neighborhoods. So, you know, I thought I could make a difference. I believe I could, and that was the goal, to try to make a difference.
Well, take us back to that first time that you were elected to office. What was the issue that made you want to run?
Well, you know, a lot of vacant boarded-up houses. I remember saying, you know, we have to eliminate some of these vacant and boarded-up houses. You know, and houses that stood there in different places in the city for seemingly forever. And number of them fire damaged. The whole issue of just having the city pie divided where it was more inclusive. Having a city workforce that was representative of the city's population and in certain departments. You know, you would go to certain departments in city government, probably there's still a few that you didn't see any minorities nor women in those positions. So it was white male dominated. And so, you know, that was my focus and that was my push. But in doing so, trying to remain fair and equitable to everybody there, and that, you know, that you could impact and maybe have some decision making over.
We talk about leadership in these kind of big, broad terms. I mean, it gets talked about a lot in Milwaukee. Can you talk about what leadership looks like and feels like to you, or what it ought to look like and feel like to you?
Well, leadership, sometimes you have to take chances. Sometimes you have to be out front, and you may be the only one out front. I remember a piece of legislation I introduced. It used to be that grocery stores that sold beer could stay open to 12 o'clock, 12, 1 o'clock. I introduced legislation that said grocery stores that sold beer would have to be uniform with liquor stores, and that's 9 o'clock closing. And I remember the first hearing that we had relative to that. You only had two people supporting it, me and one other person. You had the brewery, Miller Brewery, and a number of other folks who said, oh, no, it impacts Miller Brewery, so we want those grocery stores that sold beer to stay open because, you know, Miller's a strong employer here. So so sometimes it's like you don't look for a whole bunch of folks to follow you. You just You kind of key in. Hopefully, you know the issues. You've done some research. You observed some things, and you have to go forward and say, "I'm going to push this. I'm going to do this." And hopefully, some folks will follow you.
Do you think there's thinking like that in Milwaukee today?
A lot of issues have been dealt with, but there's always other issues coming up. I think it's key and paramount for those people in leadership positions, I'm going to say, to be well read. To know what's going on in other cities. Sometimes you can just take an idea that's in another city and transplant it to the city of Milwaukee. And so you have to have a good sense of what you want to accomplish, and you can pick up a number of ideas. It may not just come from you. It may come from others.
Keith Stanley, are there aspects to what Marvin Pratt is talking about that resonate especially strongly with what you're trying to accomplish with Near West Side Partners?
Every bit of it. And that's, once again, that's why I thought it was important to have this event, is that Milwaukee, not just Milwaukee, not just our state, not just our country, but around the world, we need leaders. We need people who can understand the complexities on the micro level and on the macro level. In the Near West Side, we have close to 30,000 people who work there and close to 30,000 people who live there. And trying to balance everything that people desire from a community and what they will like and what they don't like and what they're against, it takes good leadership. And so the value for me, the takeaway from this event and just hearing Marvin Pratt and his colleagues is getting a piece of that nugget of knowledge to say, how can we work together as a community to continue to build upon a better community? Right now in around the world, Black Panther, the movie has just taken off, and everyone's talking about it from many different ways. And in that movie, you see African-American leadership in different aspects, in ways that it can be positive for the community, in ways it can be negative. And so I'm just fascinated by this discussion on how do we, and I have to admit, I go out here on a limb, I commend a lot of our African-American elected officials and leaders, because you're almost, as W.D. Du Bois spoke about, you're almost having had to speak two different languages. You're speaking to one language, to one group of people who may not understand something, and they don't understand the complexities and the pressures and the dynamic of fundraising. And then on the other hand, you're dealing with people who don't understand the hurt and the pain and trauma of a community. And so having having discussion is amazing for me, just to hear and listen to what these leaders, I mean, I give them credit again, because they walk in these shoes every day.
You know, there's been a lot made about the lack of turnover at the top in the mayor's seat. Aside from your relatively brief tenure as technically acting mayor, but you know, either you're mayor or you're not mayor, right? There have been just four other mayors to serve here since 1948.
That's right.
What do you think the effect of such infrequent mayoral changes is on the direction of the city? Regardless of who the people are that have served for all of those years, what does not having more change in that role done in terms of where the city is or where the city could be?
Well, you know, I think, Henry Meyer served 28 years, right? From 1960 to 88, so the longest serving mayor. And then Norquist served about 16 and 18 years. So both of them came from the state Senate. So one of the things, it seemed to me, if you would look at it, maybe get elected state senator if you want to be mayor of the city of Milwaukee. But I think it was okay for that time, but I think you probably need more turnover in the mayor's office. Usually a lot of cities have term limits. They have 8 years. I can think of Nashville. I can think of Detroit. Chicago is not term limited, but a number of cities are term limited to 2 terms. And I do think you can accomplish some things in 8 years. And it lends itself, I think, being mayor more so than being in Congress. Lends itself to more creativity. You have to be somewhat creative. And I have to give kudos to Norquist. Norquist is a pretty forward-thinking person. You may not have agreed with all the things that he wanted to do, but there's some things that he wanted to do. So you have to have some ideas on how you're going to positively, as mayor, impact the city and make some changes. Mm-hmm.
The other point that's worth mentioning is that that you are the only African American to have taken the oath as mayor in this city.
That's correct.
And so, I mean, there are obviously African Americans are well represented on the Common Council, but what's the impact, you know, of you know, white leadership in a majority minority community?
Well, you know, just having a sense of. What's needed. So there has to be strong advocate. Sometimes you may not get it. And I'm not saying just because you're white, you don't know what's going on.
Right. It was an unfair question to ask that way.
I mean, but just having advocacy, maybe coming from those people who are on the Common Council. And a lot of it relates to the budget, you know, how the budget is allocated and to what it's allocated to. What kinds of problems you have, just having it more open, more receptive, having businesses in the city of Milwaukee more open and more receptive. Mitch, I think that one of the things that hurts leadership in the city of Milwaukee is this, that I think most people don't give high marks, and I'm going to say the newspaper, don't give high marks to the pejorative, it's even a pejorative term, politicians. You know, they don't give high marks to politicians for being, one, very smart, and I think it comes from the paper, and they don't, you know, and so, and the business sector, too. And so the business sector, I think the push from politicians these days has to be for the business sector to be more open to hiring minority folks, women, and other folks that they don't usually hire. And I'm saying at the top level, that's still not happening.
You're saying this is not just politics. This is politics. This is business.
And as a politician, the advocacy should come from you as the elected person to make them more inclusive.
How would you want people to think of the impact that you've had on this city, you know, whether it's in your time in elected office or behind the scenes?
Oh, I think, they say every man or a person who folks relate to, I'm just very relatable. Fact of the matter is, when I came to office, one of the models that I had as an alderman was a guy named Bob Anderson. They call him Fighting Bob Anderson. He was a Southside alderman, white alderman. And why was he a model for me? Because he had a reputation of getting city services delivered for his district. He had a reputation that he would go out and empty if the sanitation folks didn't go out and empty his constituents' trash, he would go out and do it. So I wanted to be like him in that, you know, when you called my office, you're going to get some service and you're going to get a call back, even if the answer is no. You know, where you call them back and say, I wasn't able to make that happen. But I was going to advocate strongly for those folks that I represented and for others in the city based on the issue.
Are you looking forward to sitting down with these three other gentlemen on Thursday?
I am. You know, it's I think we tend to be a little critical of one another because we, you know, we do things differently. We you know, there's not a one thought coming from all of us. You know, I would say I probably wouldn't have done that. But so I look forward to the discussion and to how we view city government. I'm sure we've a lot of commonality of viewpoints, but some differences.
I could probably sit with these guys for hours and just talk to them. And it's, once again, it's one of those dynamics of just knowing what they have. I had the opportunity to be behind the scenes working for Common Council President Willie Hines and being a chief of staff. And so you're always just amazed at what would the decision make. And I go back to that five decades because there was a different Milwaukee when Ben Johnson swore his oath and became 1976. It was a different time when Marvin, you.
Yeah. Keith, a lot of depending on your relationship with the mayor. Is it adversarial? You know, or is it, you know, you're kind of in this partnership? You know, when Ben Johnson was there, it was no ifs, ands, and buts that Henry Meyer was in control. With Norquist, you know, I think the council was more assertive. And with President Hines and Hamilton, the council was more assertive. So you can have a little back and forth, a little where you and the mayor may not get along.
Well, right. It seems like we're at a point where the relationship between the mayor and the council is in a, I don't want to say an unusual place because I'm sure it's been there before, but certainly in a challenging place.
I agree. Yeah, it's not completely acrimonious, but it's it can be heated at times, and where each one of them is kind of flexing. And generally, the council didn't have as much muscle to flex as the mayor. But it's kind of shifting.
Well, Marvin Pratt and Keith Stanley, thank you both for everything you've done and for your conversation today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Keith Stanley is executive director of Near West Side Partners. Marvin Pratt served as mayor of Milwaukee from January to April of 2004. He was also president of the Common Council from 2000 to 2004 and acting Milwaukee County executive in 2011.
He and three other Common Council presidents, Ben Johnson, Willie Hines, and current president Ashanti Hamilton, will be part of a lunchtime panel presented by Near West Side Partners tomorrow at the Triple I Shrine Center. There is more information at WUWN.com.
We'll take a quick break and then look at 10 years of the Little Food Show That Could. It's a big anniversary for Wisconsin Foodie when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. 10 years ago in a studio, not this one, we first spoke with Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherik about this dream they had. They wanted to create a TV show about food, specifically Wisconsin food, and the people who grow it, prepare it, and enjoy it.
The dream became a reality with the creation of the TV show Wisconsin Foodie, which has grown from modest origins to statewide distribution on public television and an enthusiastic following. The show is celebrating its 10th birthday, and a new episode airs this week. Arthur Ersink and Kyle Cherik join us now. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Yeah, exactly. You got to say it, Arthur. How long has it been?
Well, it has been 10 years for Wisconsin Foodies since the original iteration of the idea on the napkin and my call to Kyle Cherik and, you know, us coming together, a cocktail, and then one cold, blustery day outside of the Milwaukee Public Market.
That's right.
It's been 10 years. So on public television, it's been 8 years. And then for us doing this as a whole through commercial television, through public television, it's been 10 years.
Yeah, and I had you guys on very early on in that process because we were still in our old studio.
Yeah, down in the basement at Grand Avenue Mall as opposed to the Tony 7th floor of the Chase Building. But we were, I mean, I think that segment sounded great, but we also didn't really... Like, we knew what we were going to do, and we sort of knew what we were doing, but we also weren't sure what we were doing.
Yeah. So 10 years later, here we are. You've got a multiple award-winning show. People know who you are. It's really showcased the Wisconsin food scene in such a cool way. Mm-hmm. What did you learn along the way?
You know, I think beyond all of the awards, which, you know, isn't really necessarily important for me. It's only important that it gets our message out and it gives us more credibility to go into these spots, tell these stories. But one thing I've really taken away is the impact that we've had in Wisconsin. You know, when we both first started the show, we really wanted to spread these stories, and we were hoping that people would join us for the ride. They'd go out, they'd participate, and they'd go to some of these restaurants or some of these farms. And the response to that has been overwhelming. When we do shows now, these poor businesses, you know, it can be almost be a negative for certain small businesses because they get so much business. And for me, that is better than any award I could ever get.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly gratifying. I mean, there's a foodie bump, and it's not a term that we like to use, but the show has become its own stamp of credibility and authenticity, which I'm so pleased with because when we first started, the conversation that we had, I was really not that keen on hosting the show and being part of it. And I said, but if I did, you know, it took me a couple of days, then I called Arthur back and said, okay, let's do it. But if I do, it's got to be not scripted. It's got to be in the moment. It's got to be authentic. It's got to be, and his background as a documentary filmmaker, which I did not know at all. We were just neighbors. It was just a guy that I saw in the hallway and liked.
Just a guy.
Yeah. I mean, there was no, it wasn't like we had this long, you know, we went to high school together. There was nothing like that.
We've always wanted to do a show.
Yeah. He had this napkin and some great ideas. But the merit and the strength of the show from the very beginning was his impetus that it be completely authentic, uncontrived, true to style, documentary, no voiceover, not a personality-driven host show, which I was all about, too. We saw so much of that happening in the food media world. We felt less of that.
That celebrity thing.
Yeah. And the purveyors and the makers and the artisans and the restaurateurs and the chefs, those are the stars. And we both agreed upon that within 10 minutes of this conversation of a thing that didn't even exist. Mm. So now that they get this great gravitas and attention, and sometimes we in one case, we crashed a server, like that's our reward. And it's great that both of us feel that way. That's been the really cool part of this story.
Of all the people whose stories you're telling, are they excited to be able to share it? I mean, I always get the idea, sometimes there are craftspeople, and I include food crafts that way too, where it's like, no, just leave me alone. The reason I'm doing this in a cellar is I don't want to talk to people, and I don't want to deal with stuff. Are you finding any resistance to having their stories told?
Well, we found a few that weren't very good at telling their own story. Sorry to jump on your response, and we have filmed with people in their cellar. One guy on an exercise bike milling grain. I mean, like, you can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, that's true. And I think as a producer, once I know of a story or I want to tell a story, I'm pretty persistent, and I can make a compelling case why they should tell their story with us. And I think, you know, anybody that has a business that is trying to sell a product or, you know, is in the world, the restaurant world, just the whole food world, they want to get their product in the hands of consumers. And that's what we're here to do. We're that vehicle. You know, we make it possible. So a lot of these small producers don't have to stress out about marketing and advertising their products, where we can come and tell their story and let them do what they do best, and then let us help them, you know, get their product, you know, into the people's hands.
I think that's interesting because I don't think of you guys as marketers first and foremost, yeah. Even though that's some of what you're doing.
Well, then we're doing our jobs.
Yeah. We're storytellers.
Yeah, me, that's what this is about, is that the fact that you're selling product is secondary to the fact of telling these stories.
Right.
And I think that's what makes the show compelling.
Right. I mean, when we do a story on a great apiary and this terrific three-generation beekeeper in East Troy, we're not saying only buy their honey, though it's sublime honey. Buy honey from beekeepers that are multi-generational or stewards of the land and not packing up their bees and moving them to California and then to Vermont and then to the cherry. Mm-hmm. You know, like, support these people. And so wherever is nearby, we hope they all have an increase in sales, I guess, in interest, in awareness. That's the takeaway. But in that sense, I guess it's marketing, but it's marketing through storytelling and earnest storytelling only.
Authentic storytelling. And I think, you know, as people get more interested in buying local and supporting local, it can be difficult to find the people and the products that you're supposed to, you know, purchase when you're thinking about purchasing local. You're relying on grocery stores like Outpost Natural Foods or, you know, other local co-ops like that to find the right stuff. But for us, and like the apiary that Kyle's talking about in East Troy, Dave, who works on the land at Michael Fields Agriculture, not many people know who this man is, but he is such a dedicated beekeeper, such a dedicated honey man, and that love and passion comes through in his honey. His love for the bees comes through into the most special product you'll ever have. And for us to tell that story, now the viewer knows about him.
And we're dedicated because our cameraman and now lead editor got stung pretty bad during that episode, which actually makes the credits if anybody goes back and watches. Yeah. Sorry.
Sort of dancing around a little
bit.
He had big hair at the time.
He had
big
hair.
The bees got caught in his hair.
I mean, now that I think about it, Nelson Schneider, who is a great talent that works on the show, has had a lot of problems with insects across the years. I mean, it's just...
Well, he likes to really get in there for the shot, you know? He sacrifices his body to get the right shot, so...
What you do for art.
But what you do for art.
Part of the story of Foodie is that, you know, when it started, it was Arthur and I. He held the camera. He edited. He directed me. He produced. Sometimes we co-produced. I hosted. Like, we shot a show. I'd never shot a show before. I didn't have a journalism background. I had no interest in broadcast. So, I don't know. Is this how we do it? And he had this great doc-style background. So, we came into it with no bad habits and only, like, onward and upward, basically. And it's grown.
It can only get better from here.
Yeah. I mean, not that it was worse, but it's adding in the shooters that Arthur's able to find or these great editors that he's brought in and things like that and evolving the way that we work, it's still a very small team and it's still very intimate. But the cool part is that now, you know, you could shoot great stuff for hours and we could have another shooter and just hand it to editors.
Did you have an idea of what the foodie signature was going to be, the visual and aural signatures, or is that something that's developed over the 10 years?
I mean, it's really developed over time. You know, a big part of my, you know, what I like to bring to the table is I let people, you know, create their own paths. You know, I let artists be artists. I let them do their thing. I don't get in the way of their art. I let people bring their own style. I let, you know, Kyle brings his own art, his own style to each show. We don't script the shows. We'll talk about direction on a car ride to a certain location, but he does his own thing. We all do our own thing, and I let everybody kind of, play in the sandbox and build their own castles. And then at the end, I just kind of, you know, put everything together and you know, make sure that, you know, it's good enough for television.
Do you think Foodie propelled this huge interest in farm-to-table, you know, buying local, all of that? Or did you ride a wave that was already starting and you just kind of got in at the right time?
Well, I think it's both. To say,
yeah,
you know,
I think both.
I think we got into it at the right time, and we were just stewards of that message. right in about 2008 is when we started, and you started to see some of the shows getting into talking about, you know, I want to say farm to table and that different culinary style. And we looked at what we were doing. You know, all these shows were going national. That was the goal, is for a show to go national and everybody to have a national show. We saw the opportunity for a local show. And the message that we're trying to get across is eat local. It worked perfectly with that style. Having a Wisconsin show that was based, you know, in Wisconsin, talking about Wisconsin stories, it fits perfectly what people needed and wanted here, and it helped people make those decisions to eat local.
Right. You can always find the national voices.
Yeah. Well, the difference between Diners, Drive-Ins, and Disasters, or Bourdain or Zimmern, or pick anybody, is that they go all these places, and they're fascinating. I watch them, too. But you have to travel a lot to go there. Arthur's Edict, from the beginning, the response from viewers when we see them is like, we went to all of your shows this season. We could go there, which is so rewarding. And I didn't really get it. I was thinking more in national terms in the early years. And it was this epiphanic moment when we were out in New York. Two Wisconsin chefs were up for the James Beard Award. And I ran into Dan Barber, who's a huge voice both for great agriculture and great cooking. Ran into him in the hallway. It's just he and I. And I introduced myself shyly. And he said, "Oh, I'm a Wisconsin foodie." And I thought, yeah, we've had amazing agriculture, chef talent, restaurant, everything. We just need to tell people, remind them about it again. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the show does, because we've been punching above our own weight, to use that phrase, for generations. But our show shows people where and how that's happening. And that's very rewarding.
Do you see any changes in the future? Now, you know, you've got 10 years under your belt. Here's to another 10 or 20.
We're always experimenting. We're always trying to tell different stories. We're always tweaking the show. I'm never comfortable doing the same thing and becoming formulaic. That is one thing that from day one has been my goal, is to never do the same show twice. You know, never get caught in those traps of making the show that you know people want to see. People want to see shows about pizza. People want to see shows about barbecue. But, you know, we've got to be careful just to keep changing and moving in different directions and telling different stories. You know, personally, one thing that we've had fun doing lately is we've done several travel stories, connecting other parts of the world to Wisconsin. You know, we just got back from Oktoberfest in Munich, and that was such an incredible story to see. You know, I mean, we spend our weekends at the Esterbrook Beer Garden. But to go to an actual beer garden in Munich and make that relationship is just fascinating. And, you know, we'll have some pushback where people say, you could stay in the state of Wisconsin. Why did you have to leave Wisconsin? But I think that on the flip side, we're just educating people as to why they're doing the things that they're doing, you know, mm-hmm. What the history is from that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I always like to say, you know, local doesn't necessarily just mean your backyard. Mm. You know, we're all global citizens.
When the show first started, or when we had the first ideas of Wisconsin Foodie, it was a really restaurant chef focused show. But the more time I spent with chefs, they started talking more about the products they were using. You know, the different farmers they were excited about, the pickle maker, all the different product makers around Wisconsin and farmers around Wisconsin. And that's where I started falling in love with those stories. So I let the people dictate where the stories are going. You know, what are the chefs interested in? What are the farmers interested in? What do they need? You know, the beautiful thing we've seen with the farmers is there's a lot more younger people going into the farming world mm-hmm. now than mm-hmm. when we first started. It is incredible. And you know what? They're really passionate. They're really business savvy. They're resourceful. I mean, they're creating, you know, all these different added value things for the farm, you know, like a burger night on the farm. We just did a story on Together Farms. And here's this young, passionate family that's getting into grass-feeding animals, grass-feeding beef and pigs. And they're having burger nights on the farm. They're inviting the community to come out to the farm, and they're serving burgers on the farm. It's just a fabulous thing that they're doing. They're really connected with the chef world. They're savvy in social media, and that's something we didn't see 10 years ago.
None of us
right.
really
yeah.
were doing much on social media.
We never foresaw that, and if we can take credit for something in that, I think Wisconsin Foodie has helped for that generation make it sexy, make it a legitimate way to make a living, make them realize they're part of a larger culture that is happening in all sorts of parts of the state. Mm-hmm. And it's not just three or four of them that are doing it.
Right.
And that there's a support network of chefs that watch the show and restaurateurs and people that go to farmers markets that want to buy their the things that they grow. And I think that's the takeaway. I think we can take some credit for that. And and we're glad. We're glad. I mean, that's...
I've heard it multiple times where our show has inspired somebody to leave their job that they hated so much that may have been paying decently to go into something that they really loved, whether it be making a product or into farming. I've heard that multiple times.
No pressure there, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, no pressure.
Yeah. I mean, well, how fantastic.
It's inspiring for people.
It is.
People,
it's really, you know, it's really inspiring. Yeah.
They see other people and say, I can do this. This is the inspiration I need to just say, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to do it because, you know, all the money in the world isn't as important as your happiness and doing what you want to do in life.
Well, gentlemen, congratulations on the 10 years. And
thank
here's
you,
to many, many more. And I look forward to many more conversations.
Thank you, Bonnie. Appreciate
cool.
it. Thank you.
Arthur Ersink is founder and executive producer. And Kyle Cherik is host of Wisconsin Foodie. It airs on public television stations around the state. You can listen back to the original interview I did with them when they launched the show 10 years ago at WUWM.com. Forgive me if I'm just a little embarrassed to do that, Mitch.
I know your voice hadn't changed yet. Well, if Wisconsin Foodie goes behind the scenes for food, we will do the same thing for Wisconsin Drink when we return in a moment. We'll get the story of Twisted Path Distillery in Bayview when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Earlier this year, we visited Twisted Path Distillery for our Lake Effect on-site event in Bayview. The company is a micro-distillery founded by Brian Sammons.
Sammons took his own twisted path to becoming a distiller and has an equally unorthodox approach to his work. Lake Effect's Joy Powers headed over to Bayview to talk to Sammons in the heart of the operation, the distillery.
So what am I looking at right here? I'm looking at, just to describe the room, there's a bunch of what I would describe as vats.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what those are. Those are the fermenters, or three of the fermenters. I got three in here and three in the next room. That's where the yeast turns the sugar into alcohol. So step one is mashing, which you saw over here, and was making a little bit too much noise, but that's where I take a fermentable and add hot water, essentially.
What's a fermentable?
Like for my vodka, I make from wheat, but you could do it from lots of things. You could do it from sugar. You could do it from other grains. You could do it from grapes, make wine. But I make whiskey from grains, vodka from wheat. Rum is from sugarcane. In my case, I use sugarcane molasses. So something that you either has a starch that you convert to a sugar or has sugar in it that then ultimately yeast will eat to make the alcohol.
Okay.
So mixing that the right way, mashing it, to make that thing that yeast can ferment. That's what mashing is all about. And then we load it in one of these vats, I guess. I call them fermenters, but it's really the same thing. It's a 320-gallon tank. I do batches that are about 300 gallons. But sometimes they ferment so fast that it'll foam over. So actually having the tank be a little bit extra tall helps not have that happen and saves on me mopping quite so much.
I would imagine so, yeah.
There were some mistakes early on and lots of mopping. But now I've got the process dialed in and that doesn't happen anymore.
Are you self-taught? Is that an accurate way to put this?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I subsequently went to one professional distilling class just to sort of check in and make sure I'm not missing something, but I confirmed that I'm fine. I didn't really learn anything from it, but that was probably actually reassuring that I didn't learn anything from it. Yeah, I'm self-taught. I started out small and just built up from there. I mean, there's a lot of micro distilleries around the country. There are distilleries of all sizes. And my approach was just to research how they would do any particular thing, and then their overall big picture. But then for each of those things, I would sort of reevaluate and look at, okay, that's how a normal commercial distillery does something, but why do they do it that way? Is there some good reason for that? Do I have any ideas that I think would be a better way to do it? What I found in this industry is that conventional wisdom, it's not necessarily conventional wisdom because it's the best way to do something. I find that conventional wisdom, it's almost an evolutionary process in and of itself, where I think a lot of people, when they start a business, there's so many things to figure out and so many decisions to be made by the person starting it, that for the most part, they just look at what other people around them are doing and they just do that. Because, hey, other people are doing it, it seems to work, I don't really want to figure it out myself, so I'm just going to do what everybody else does. So over time, that just evolves. And you end up with conventional wisdom being a bunch of things that aren't necessarily the best way to do things. So I sort of reinvented the wheel. It took a really long time to get this place built because a lot of stuff I sort of reinvented from scratch.
What are some examples of that in the room that we're looking at right now?
One would be the water heater. The conventional way to heat up water for mashing is called a hot liquor tank. And it's a big stainless steel thing that it's a steam jacket, a steam heated vessel. The vessel itself is very expensive. The steam boiler to power it's very expensive. Installation of it's very expensive. And in the end, you're talking about nearly $50,000 to heat up water, which to me was sort of, you know, okay, well, if that somehow tastes better than just water that's hot, maybe I'll go with that. But does that taste better? Is it fancy hot water? Or is it just the same water you started with, hotter? And it turns out that's all it is. And there's much easier, cheaper, more efficient ways to heat up water. So I built my own water heater. And sure enough, it cost about a 20th as much and does the same thing. It turns the hot, takes the water you put into it and makes it hot. So as a result, you know, I evaluate something like that and say, okay, well, if the normal way to do this tastes better, I'll do that. No questions asked. The ultimate goal is uncompromising on the quality of the product in the end. And then where conventional wisdom says, well, sure, it tastes better, but it's not cost effective, I've saved the money elsewhere, I can put it into that. It's a matter of focusing priorities. Another example of unconventional would be the still.
Yeah, I'm looking at this. This looks almost steampunk, which now as I'm saying it, sounds like.
Actually, that's a little ironic because the goal, this is a prototype still I built, and the point of it was to avoid having to have it be steam-powered, so it's kind of funny that you call it steampunk. It's electric punk. So when I was looking for a commercial still, there wasn't one that worked quite the way I wanted to. I wanted to be able to do what's called grain-in distilling, and I wanted to be able to do it with an electric still instead of having to get a steam boiler and steam power it. Advantageous for a lot of reasons for a startup distillery. So this is a prototype, and it looks sort of do-it-yourself-ish because it is. my dad and I built the wood surround, and I designed the heating elements. I have a patent pending on them. I found somebody to hand hammer a copper pot. And then I found all these other various parts from various places, and some of them I modified myself. I taught myself to weld in the process and modified some of them. So this is actually electric punk more than steampunk, but it's a prototype. So once the mash ferments, it'll ferment to like beer or wine in terms of percentage alcohol. Yeast can't get higher proof than that. It can't get higher proof alcohol than like a strong wine. That's when then you have to distill it if you want to have stronger alcohol. So that's what this does, is you load something in this that has alcohol, it boils it. So what you're looking at is just a giant pot, but it's a pot with a lid and a channel coming out of it, and it directs the steam coming off your boiling alcoholic liquid because the steam has higher proof alcohol in it. So you direct that over to a condenser. It just provides a cold surface so that that hot alcohol vapor hits that cold surface, condenses back to a liquid, and you collect it. This one has four of them, four little submarine windows, making it a pretty short column. That kind of a still, a pot still with four columns on, or four plate column on it, is great for making full flavored spirits in one run. So what I mean by full flavored spirits are spirits that have a lot of character from what you fermented. So rum, brandy, whiskey, tequila, those kinds of things. The characteristic flavor of those spirits is from what you fermented. That's why the rules defining what those are, and there's rules on all of this, the main rule is what you ferment. And four plates like this is perfect for doing one of those kinds of spirits where you bring over a lot of flavor, but still it still gives the distiller a lot of control to emphasize or de-emphasize different parts of the run and different flavors.
What would be considered not full flavored?
Vodka. So vodka, and then there's a lot of things you make with vodka, like gin or liqueurs and things like that, but that you first make vodka. Actually, in the federal rules that define these things, there's no rule on what you ferment for vodka because the rules have to do with distilling the taste out. The rules, in a nutshell, are distill it to really, really high proof, over 190, which is close to as high as you can get, and be neutral tasting. I'm air quoting that. Because, I mean, if we're being honest, how do you really enforce that law? Like, neutral tasting to some people is not so neutral to others. But the gist of it is they don't care what you fermented because you're supposed to be distilling the taste of what you fermented out of it. And to accomplish those goals, 190 proof or higher and relatively neutral tasting, you need a whole bunch of these plates. You need to really distill the bejesus out of it, basically. And that's a very different goal. It's the opposite goal when you're trying to make a full-flavored booze. For vodka, you're trying to take out most of the flavor.
One of the things you mentioned on vodkas was the triple distilling it. And as we've gone through this, that seems confusing. You go, there's all of these plates and...
Yes. The reason that's confusing when you come on a tour like this and then you talk about the number of times distilled when it comes in vodka marketing, the reason that's confusing is because you're looking at the disparity between reality, where you stand right here, and marketing. The number of times distilled in vodka marketing is, to the extent I've ever seen it, all fake. To make vodka, to get it to this high a proof, you need to use a reflux column like this to get over 190 proof. And then your number of distillations is a theoretical number based on the number of plates, the efficiency of the plates, and your reflux ratio. But in order to get to 190 proof, it's a really high number of distillations. Triple does not make vodka, like according to science. Distilling something that yeast fermented three times won't get you to high enough proof to be vodka. And in fact, in vodka marketing, that it's just the marketing departments come up with these numbers because they sound good.
You didn't start out in distilling.
No, this is sort of a third career. This was sort of a side career or a side hobby. Okay. Well, home distilling is illegal.
So
I definitely didn't do that.
It definitely did not happen.
Didn't do that, but I thought a lot about it. And I was getting good at thinking about it. The thoughts were tasting great. And it's sort of a long story, the whole career path and how I ended up going into distilling. But essentially, I was on a career path that would have entailed traveling around the world. My wife was on a career path that would have entailed traveling at least around the country, if not around the world, when we met in Madison when we were both in law school. And we decided to prioritize living in Milwaukee and raising kids here. And then we decided that jobs come second. Careers come second, kids and family come first. And so I became a lawyer because I had just gone to law school. And I was doing that for a while. I was a DA here in town, which was interesting. And then I went to a law firm. By the time I got to a law firm, what I realized was, A, I didn't like my job. Big surprise there. And B, it was also going to screw up how we wanted to do family life because I worked too many hours and I was at the beck and call of somebody else all the time. In which case, you know, I was going to screw up family life and not like my job. Well, in my previous career, I could get at least one of those. I'd like my job but screw up family life. I used to be a CIA officer and we could go back to the CIA. I could go to the CIA and travel the world and really like my job but screw up family life. Or we could follow my wife's career in academia, move around and screw up family life, but she'd love her job. So we just went back to the drawing board. Said, okay, blank slate, what is it we want to do? And then we'll try to figure out what our best choices are. And it was still to raise kids in Milwaukee. That was still our number one priority. Okay, well then what do we want for careers? We looked around at people who had the life we were looking for. It was people that had their own business and it was something they loved doing. So you could be your own boss. I can take off for a kid's soccer game or whatever. But that the day in, day out, of course you're gonna have to work a lot, and that goes with anything. And this just fit the bill. It was something I loved doing, something I felt like I was good at, theoretically, because home distilling is illegal, don't do that. It also seemed to be a good fit between the hard parts of doing this fit well with my strengths.
Why is it called Twisted Path?
The Twisted Path name comes from a philosophical concept that my wife and I embrace. The path aspect first, it's embracing life as a path, sort of a Buddhist point of view of, you know, life is a series of moments, and if you live it focused on the next moment, you're never really in the present, you're never really enjoying your life. So living life as a path, and the twisted aspect is rejecting convention and following your own path. Do what works for you, not disregarding expectations of others and what conventional wisdom might think you should do.
What are the biggest things that people get wrong about distilling? When you do these tours, when you're talking to people about the process, what are the biggest misconceptions?
I think a lot of them come from marketing, but you know, they're all over the map. There's the number of times distilled thing. There's Oh, a big one that I run into that's just sort of a dividing line between spirits fans and people that aren't quite as into it would be the only measure of a spirit is how smooth it is, in air quotes. And that it just sort of its drinkability. And that mostly relates to, is it higher proof or not? Things like that. That's one thing that can kind of present itself pretty often. Where it can be an issue with something like my white rum, for example. White rum as a category is not really made for sipping. It's made for making cocktails. Daiquiris and mojitos and things with umbrellas in it, right? And in that kind of a cocktail, you need a strong, assertive spirit. So I made my white rum to be exactly that. But if you sip it by itself, you might not describe it as smooth. It's not supposed to be smooth. It's supposed to be present in a cocktail. Not in an alcohol solvent-y way, but have a big, bold flavor. Some of the other misconceptions would be just, I think, believing a lot of marketing you see elsewhere. Oh, a big one. As a distiller that has celiacs and cannot consume gluten, that spirits couldn't have gluten. I think this is the marketing of one company in particular led a lot of people by just saying gluten-free all day long on their labels and in their advertising gave people the impression there's a vodka that touts their being gluten-free. That's true, but it gave everybody the misconception that vodka might not be gluten-free. Vodka's gluten-free. I make wheat vodka and I have celiacs and I drink it all day long. Not every day, not all day, every day, but I drink it a lot. And, The simple fact is gluten doesn't evaporate. It's like putting rocks in a pot and trying to boil it, and then you can drink the steam. It is gluten does not distill. That's a scientific fact. The only way a distilled spirit has gluten is if the manufacturer somehow added gluten after distillation, which would almost never happen. The only thing I can think of is like a whiskey if they aged it in a beer barrel. Because beer has gluten, because it's not distilled. And if you put the whiskey in the beer barrel, that's after distillation, it could pick up some of the gluten from the beer in the barrel. So I won't drink a whiskey that's aged in a beer barrel.
But otherwise?
Other than that, distilled spirits are gluten-free, and I drink them all the time.
There you go.
Brian Sammons is the distiller and founder of Twisted Path Distillery in Bayview. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about his work, and there is more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's somewhat, well, should we say tipsy edition of the show, Mitch?
Sounds about right. I'm trying to keep things in focus. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Mitch Tyke.
I'm Bonnie North. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next. It's a shame there was